Causey here. Glad to have you with us. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. and glad you're along, and tell a friend. My guests today are actually two guests. The primary guest is Walton Francis. He is editor of the Washington Consumer Checkbook. It's the Bible. It's the book for people who are looking for the best health insurance deal for the year 2014. Walt has been doing this for 30-plus years, so he knows his stuff. And then coming on later in the show, Andy Medici from the Federal Times will bring us up to speed on other things that are going on. Walt, welcome. I understand the Fairfax County Parkway was not fun this morning.
I shudder to think, the people who couldn't get around it somehow.
Oh, Northern Virginia, just pray for us all, you know. Got a batch of questions here from people, and let me go through these first, and then we'll start talking about generalities. Here's from a mom in waiting at the State Department. Quick question. I'm expectant mother, due April 2014. Plan to add my future child and husband to my health plan. Which would be best in terms of maternity, prenatal, and postpartum care? Blue Cross Basic or Standard?
I'm going to slightly dodge the answer to that, Mike, mm-hmm. because there's two more general points to make.
Yeah.
First, most of the FEHVP plans give you a special deal on maternity. They will cover typically your prenatal and perinatal, you know, the doctor visits part, at either zero cost or very low cost. And they'll typically cover the delivery and the hospital fee for zero. Okay.
Wow.
So what you want to do is realize you can be in almost any plan. Okay. And there's some differences here. So, you know, what you do is you get the brochure out and you compare them side by side, and maybe $100 one way or the other may or may not matter to you. But the really important thing is, since so many plans give you this close to 100% coverage, talk to your obstetrician or your gynecologist about which plans are you in the network, because everything is predicated on using a physician.
Absolutely.
In the network.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
Let's say your physician is in Blue Cross and Aetna and GEHA. Well, then you kind of, and a couple of HMOs, you've got no problem. But your physician may be one of those who's in the United network, but not the Blue Cross network. So that's where to start.
Okay, so she's got a lot of choices. Go to the doctor, see which plan he or she's in.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see here. I'm a retired Fed under Medicare Part B. What's the cheapest good policy I can sign up for, which would fill in the gaps and serve as a supplement policy, paying for the remainder of my medical costs not covered by Medicare? In other words, the other 20% not covered by A and B. I currently have Blue Cross Basic.
Okay. He's got several choices that are rather more frugal than Blue Cross Basic. He probably doesn't want to move to an HMO, so I'll skip those choices. But for sure, he should take a look at GEHA standard option. Okay, it's about a $300 saving in premium costs compared to basic. And there are I'm just looking, APWU consumer driven, about a $400 saving. Okay, so and National Association of Letter Carriers consumer driven. You got to check, those plans don't wrap around. So I would say GEHA, that is, give you that 100% guarantee. So I would look at GEHA standard. The only pitfall with that is that the prescription drug coverage is not nearly as good. They only pay 50% of the cost of name brand drugs. So if your drug costs are high, GEHA won't be your best choice. I might also add, he mentions basic, but basic doesn't give you that 100% wraparound either. That's the only one of the national plans that doesn't give you that 100% deal. So you really want to be looking at GEHA or one of the other plans I mentioned that's got a somewhat lower premium.
Okay, very good. Struggling to find good FEHBP information, living overseas, for defense and State Department workers. Do you have any general guidance? More specifically, differences between Blue Cross Standard and the basic for overseas employees is very minimal for both plans when overseas.
I think that customer needs to relook at the brochures. Blue Cross Basic says you get no coverage out of network, and the network is entirely the United States, except in an emergency when you're abroad, is my recollection. I could be misremembering. I know that's the case when you're in the United States, and I don't think their benefit improves abroad. Blue Cross Standard, on the other hand, covers you fully anywhere in the world, whether or not it's an emergency. But there are a couple other choices. The Foreign Service Plan is open to pretty much, it's not just people in the Foreign Service, pretty much any American who's posted abroad all those Americans will also be eligible for Foreign Service, and indeed many people in the states that work in the Defense and Foreign Affairs community.
Agriculture Department even.
If you're an agricultural attaché, you could join the Foreign Service Plan. And it, of course, specializes in handling you abroad. And it's a very good buy. One of the three or four best buys overall among our national plans. So I would for sure check out Foreign Service. And I would take a look at GEHA Standard. And make sure that if you're going to keep Blue Cross Basic in the mix, that it really does cover you for routine care abroad.
Sort of a generic question here from Joan. Says, can you please ask Walt why the premiums for the FEHBP program went up so much? Care First Blue Choice for 2014 is going up approximately $126 a month. Might add that the average increase for employees and retirees is 4.4%, but averages mean almost nothing. You know, right. Mississippi River is 6 feet deep on average.
Yeah. What's going on for the? There are two things that cause the seemingly strange premium ups and downs. And by the way, for everyone that goes up a whole bunch, there's a whole lot more that are close to a zero increase or even some negative.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, it's not all one direction. Each plan has to cover the costs of the people in that plan. And if they have attracted a disproportionate share of some of the older and sicker people, their premiums are going to have to go up to cover them. The other thing is they have to forecast every year their likely costs because they don't really have the experience. You know, they don't know yet who's going to enroll in 2014, but they have to announce the 2014 premium now. And sometimes there's an overshoot or undershoot in those estimates. And then the next year, they have to, you know, either make it up by a bigger increase or they can hold their premium down because they collected a little bit too much. So it's tricky. I guess the point I would make about Care First is that the standard option is a far, far better buy than the high option. Indeed, it's one of the best buy HMOs in our ratings. So do consider seriously switching to Care First Standard, and that'll solve that problem.
Okay, here's one from Christopher at NIH. Said, like many, I have not changed or even looked into other health plans for going on 17 years of federal service. I have Standard Blue Cross Blue Shield. I must have missed something way back because I always thought I had the Standard, not the high. Did that change to Standard and Basic? Anyway, I'm married with three daughters. We're all healthy. Going back and forth with my wife about switching from the Standard to Basic. After listening to your show last week, it seems the best option from what I understood. The biggest difference is out-of-network issues. But anyhow, again, so many people keep asking about Blue Cross Standard, which I believe is number one in popularity, and Blue Cross Basic, which is number two in popularity.
Yeah, and the people who are still – look, many people should be in Standard. It has some significant advantages, mostly having to do with out-of-network access. But Basic is just a far better buy, and unless you really are wedded to multiple out-of-network providers, you ought to go with Basic. In any case, you ought to be using network providers, whatever plan you're in. You join Basic, you save enough in premium that you can still see someone out-of-network and be way ahead. It's a shame. Too many people sit on their rear ends they're watching Redskins games or something. Those have gotten kind of boring.
Why, one wonders.
Yeah, why bother? But spend a half an hour. Check things out. By the way, Standard, High, Basic, Value, all these names these plans have, they have not too much meaning anymore. In some plans, High option is the more expensive. Pricey spread. In the case of Blue Cross, what's called Standard option is the more pricey spread.
Good enough. Have to take a short break here. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. Hey, Mike Causey here. Welcome to Your Turn. Talking with Walton Francis. He is the longtime editor, more than 30 years, of the Washington Consumer Checkbook. And, Walt, I don't know how you do it, following all these changes and going to the various seminars and groups. I know you've had some with Congressman Von Hollen. You're having one coming up with NARF right down the street here from us. But anyhow, I commend your energy, and this is being able to keep up with this. Got one more question, then we just sort of go to generalities. And this is kind of a non-insurance question, but from Joan, and she said, is there some place to go for help when you're caught between the insurance company and the doctors? The doctor says you owe money, and the insurance company says they paid the bill. I mean, I would think presenting the bill to the doctor would take care of that.
You'd think so. On the other hand, you know, insurance is a complicated and messy business. We're all used to getting those statements that say, you know, here's what the doctor charged, here's what we covered, here's what we paid, and you owe, and sometimes it's zero, and you say, how can that be? And sometimes it's a number that it looks like they can't pull out of a hat. I think, I would take the bill to the doctor's office and, you know, and try to calm them down. The other thing that's going on in a more general way, all these requirements for, like, pre-approval of CAT scans and so on, this drives the doctors crazy. You know, they'll be on the phone with some, you know, MBA person who not even a medical person who's going to decide whether or not I get to have a CAT scan, you know, which, and it may save my life to have it sooner rather than later. It's just, you know, it's a mess and that doesn't look to be getting better either.
I call it the Judge Judy rule. He who shows up with the most papers usually wins. but anyhow, back to sort of generalities. We're about midway here in the open season. Your consumer checkbook is available for $9.95. You can mail it in, but the thing that I know you're so excited about is the online version. And you sent me a list of the agencies that are subscribing to it for their employees, and it's staggering how many places from social agencies like EPA and Health and Human Services, which you might expect, to the penny pinchers like at the Congressional Budget Office. But they are subscribed for their employees, and you say there's a savings to the government for this.
Yeah, let me just say that. But first the consumers. Yeah. If you're interested in seeing the real source of all this information, I'm trying to summarize. Checkbook's Guide to Health Plans for Federal Employees. It's online at www.guidetohealthplans.org. Right on the home page, you can check whether or not your agency has bought you a free subscription. If so, no further ado, and you can. And if you need to buy your own, it's inexpensive. I could simply say that it is likely to save, and we've made calculations based on those who use it and on those who don't use it. It's likely to save a typical family anywhere from $500 to $2,000 or $3,000 a year if they use our guide and select one of the less expensive plans, less expensive in terms of premium and out-of-pocket costs, which is the big thing we bring to this. What are, you know, at a certain age and family size, your out-of-pocket costs won't be the same as someone who's a lot younger and their family's smaller. And we take that into account in our plan ratings and actually estimate dollar differences. But, yeah, also the point here is agencies pay 75% of the premium for most plans. So they get three quarters of whatever premium savings come from these choices. And premiums are most of the cost. So the agencies that subscribe make themselves a lot of money. I don't know if the HR, it's usually the HR people who contract with us, and they're doing it as an employee service, and bless them for that service. Mm-hmm. It's a huge service. But they may not realize, but they're also saving their agency a fair amount of money. I mean, it's a $50 billion program. There's lots of money to save, and we're in the middle of, sequestration and all that. Every nickel counts, even to a federal agency.
And you make the point, rightly so, that when people look at premiums alone, that's wrong, because in an average year, you're going to have X amount of things. In a catastrophic year, you want to look at the limit to you on some of these plans, and they vary by $5,000-$6,000 as to how much out of pocket you will have to pay.
Yeah, there's a lot of variation, and there's also a gotcha hidden there. A lot of people just glance at a summary of benefits for their plan or for some other plan without realizing that there's some fine print, you know, small print behind those summaries. And sometimes there'll be a stated catastrophic limit, like, you know, $8,000 out of pocket. Well, then you go look at the brochure section that really explains it, and it's $8,000 plus your copays for doctor visits, plus your copays for prescription drugs, and it could really effectively in the real world be more like $10,000 or $12,000.
Well, that reminds me of a question that I have not had this year. Normally, it comes up a lot, but somebody will say, "My wife and I were both federal workers, but I like an HMO, and she likes Blue Cross Standard or Samba or Foreign Service, one of those excellent plans. So why don't we get two plans?"
You can do it. If assuming you're both feds, and let's say you both like HMOs, then it's two different HMOs. That's fine. That'll work fine because you're not going to ever be out of pocket much in an HMO. Enough to push you towards these very high catastrophic levels of cost. But if, let's say, there's two of you in fee-for-service plans, you're in a car crash, each of you gets badly hurt, instead of one family out-of-pocket maximum of, say, $6,000, you're going to each pay a family out-of-pocket maximum of, say, $6,000. So there's a risk to enrolling in two self-onlys to save, you know, $100, $200 in premium compared to with one family enrollment.
Which brings up the idea of self plus one. The government, as people obviously know, there are two categories now. You're either a self and only, or if you're two or more, it's a family. The self plus one idea is not, the time has not arrived, correct?
No, the problem with that is that all these premiums are set based on the characteristics and costs of the people who enroll in that category. Well, guess who the families are? They're young couples with three small kids kind of people. Kids are cheap. Guess who the self plus one people mostly are? They are 50-year-olds, empty nesters, and 50-year-olds cost three or four times as much as 30-somethings. So if you want to be in that group, that pool of people who are 50-plus, retired or semi-retired couples, you're going to be in a group of very expensive subscribers, and you will probably pay more than the family premium. So that's why the OPM actuaries have made these calculations, and that's why it's never made sense to create this third category. The FEHEP includes retirees in the same premiums in the pool as active employees, which is really pretty unusual. In the private sector, that's rarely done. So self plus one makes a lot more sense there. They don't have any geezers category. But in the federal employee program, you do.
That's very interesting because every email I've received on the subject, and I've probably gotten 20 since open season, they're from an older person, presumably, well, a couple, obviously, and they say, why should I pay for young people to have babies? And I think, A, this is a group plan, and maybe at some point you were a young person and had babies, and somebody was carrying you in the group. But as you're pointed out, the older couple is still more expensive.
Yeah, and in fact, reality, younger federal employees are subsidizing the older federal employees and retirees in a major way. There's an unknown number, but probably more than 100,000 federal employees, mostly the young and healthy ones, who haven't even signed up for federal employee coverage because the plans, they're not real expensive. In fact, they're pretty inexpensive. The government pays three quarters of the premium, and some of them have pretty low premiums. But for whatever reasons, they figure they'd rather make payments on their motorcycle than their health insurance.
Well, you call them the immortals, too. Nothing can happen to me. It's funny, the American Federation of Government Employees estimated that number at 250,000.
I know.
And they said, they were going to be hit by the Affordable Care Act, but you're skeptical of that number.
Well, I'm not saying it's wrong. It's got to be a big number, and AFGE may be estimating it correctly. They're pretty responsible, I have a great admiration for their work when I hear them testify and so on. But those young employees they're among those who are required to buy health insurance.
And they're the ones you want in a group plan, don't you?
Yeah. If enough of them join the FEHEP, it'll bring down premiums for everybody else.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What sort of general advice do you give people? They're shopping. Nobody likes to do this. You have to be pretty wonky to like to go through health insurance brochures. You guys have made it easy. I like your book, but I'm a book guy. But I have looked at the online thing, and you can type in your location and zip code, and even find doctors and things that are within the area. So if you're a wired person, it is superb. But even so, what should people be looking for? I mean, I would think one of the number one things after you've narrowed down some plans is go to your doctor, see if he or she is in it, as you said earlier.
Yeah, and by the way, that's on the online version of Checkbook's Guide. You can, in the D.C. metro area, you can actually type in a few your doctor's name or a couple of doctor's names, and when you get right away practically to our, believe me, this this is an this exchange is not, that works, right away you will see which plans your doctor's in the network, so it'll help narrow your choice. But clearly, you're looking for a plan that covers the doc you really need to keep, if there is one, or you're willing to trade off and join a real inexpensive plan and just pay the doctor out of pocket, maybe using a flexible spending account. But the main thing I would say, and I think what most – we know that most people care about this is, what are the lower-cost plans? And that's where we try to zero in laser-like. You know, of the 30-plus plans available in the D.C. metro area, we will show you which, for a family of your size and your age and your health status and your, you know, pay system and whether or not you're retired and whether or not you have Medicare – taking all that into account, we will tell you which plans are the better buys and by how much, how many dollars you can save.
I've done a couple of columns on this based on your work entirely. And for the fee-for-service plans, the standard, the nationwide ones, the ones that people are familiar with, you rank them by premium and by benefits to people. Blue Cross Basic, GEHA Standard, Foreign Service, NALC, High Option, APW High Option, Compass Rose, which is CIA and related agencies, and Samba, which is
standard
law
option.
Enforcement. Standard option. That's law enforcement. But I haven't talked much about the health maintenance organizations, the HMOs. And I know in the past you've been high on them, both for things like maternity benefits and just for minimal out-of-pocket costs.
And convenience. I mean, you don't have to open those yellow pages and try to find a doctor, or, you know, I mean, you do still have to choose from the plan network, but they've narrowed your choices and they've screened out the marginal doctors, okay? So that's a big plus. In the case of Kaiser, they've really streamlined it for you. I mean, it's soup to nuts, all in one facility. So HMOs are a different kind of way of delivering health care. A lot of them are pretty close in operation to the national fee-for-service PPO plans, but they're distinctly different. They typically have premiums as high or even a little higher, though not all do, as the national plans. But the out-of-pocket costs are invariably lower. And we find several of them are just superb buys in the D.C. area. You know, Kaiser Standard, Care First Standard, which we had a question about. Well, standard option is a great deal. The Kaiser High Option also, the Coventry High Option in Maryland, the Aetna Open Access Basic. I mean, these are good buys. People ought to check them out.
Once again, for people who have Medicare, and as my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, everybody gets A if you're eligible for Medicare.
Right.
And B is what?
That's the doctor part.
Doctor part, okay.
You have to pay a premium. There's a standard premium.
Oh, excuse me. Lauren Larson has given me the hook again here. We'll take a short break here on Federal News Radio, AM 1500 and federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey, and I'm talking with Walton Francis. He's the editor of the Washington Consumer Checkbook Guide to Federal Employee Health Plans for 2014. And, Walton, looking at your book now, and we talked about the online version, and I know that's kind of your baby, you like that. But I've been looking in the book here, and you do best buys for people, a variety of things, singles, family of two, family of five, people 55 and 65, older people, those with Medicare and whatnot, and you rank them in order of premiums and likely out-of-pocket costs for that year. And again, there are all kinds of categories, a really good year, a really bad year, what you're going to shell out. The thing I think that probably confuses so many people, myself included, is this middle bracket here. We have the health maintenance organizations and the preferred provider options at the top, and I understand what those are. The national plans of fee-for-service, we all understand those, you know, GEHA, Samba, Foreign Service, NALC, Blue Cross. But there's one here, CDHPs and HDHPs, and I feel like I'm going into a computer store, Eyeless in Gaza. What are those all about?
Those are two new kinds of plants, actually, but they're closely related. They're very popular in the private sector. Office of Personnel Management, which runs this program, and it's just, a really good managing agency, I decided several years ago to ask the plans to come in with these options that are so common in the Fortune 500, and a lot of the plans responded by coming in with them. The high deductible plan basically does two things that are different. It gives you a very high deductible for a family. It could be $2,000, okay? And they give you what's called a health savings account. And it might be, I'll say, $1,200. Mm-hmm. These two numbers vary a bit from plan to plan, okay? The idea is that you're going to be in charge of deciding your health care costs to a substantial extent, your utilization. You're going to think hard about whether or not you want that CAT scan, because if you get that CAT scan, it's going to use up your health savings account and put you into this big deductible area. Once you come out of the deductible, it's regular and very good health insurance. All these plans have very good catastrophic protection, no loopholes, no they're not playing any games with you. Mm-hmm. And so this is for people who want to kind of be – it's sort of the opposite of people who want to be in an HMO and have the plan do most of the
you're managing your own care.
You're managing your own care. But, of course, you're in the same healthcare system as the rest of us. Anyway, so these plans offer – they have very low premiums relative to the national plans. And they offer a spectacular opportunity. In a high deductible plan, you get a health savings account. That's money that's tax preferred going in. If you have a good year, your annual physical and maybe just a couple of generic drugs and a doctor visit or two, you don't have to use the health savings account. In any event, you won't use up very much of it. And it carries over. It's not use or lose money. It's your money forever. It rolls over every year. Next year, you can add more to it. If you have a couple of healthy years in a row and your account builds up, you can invest it in the stock market even. Let's say it gets to the level after a couple, it'll be more like 5 or 6 or 8 years of $15,000 or $20,000. At that point, you'll never have to pay any out-of-pocket health care costs again if you don't want to, because you can always use your health savings account for that. When you retire, the money is still growing all tax-free all these years. When you retire, you can take money out tax-free. And after age 65, you can even take it out for things that aren't health-related. So it's like an IRA on steroids. The consumer-driven plans are similar. The big difference is that this savings account is usually called a personal account or a health reimbursable arrangement, and it's not your money, it's the plan's money. So it's carryover. It can, accumulate over time, but you can't invest it, and if you leave the plan in a future open season, the plan keeps it, not you. But both these close cousin types of plans are superb choices for most people of most ages. And by the way, as you near retirement, you can put in what are called catch-up contributions and tax shelter even more of your money.
Now, if they have you have a high deductible, say $2,000, and they give you a savings account worth $1,200, could I use the $1,200 to satisfy the high deductible?
Yeah, you could. Well, $1,200 of it, yes.
Yeah.
Or you could choose not to and pay the whatever part of the $2,000 you hit out of pocket to build up your savings account, because that money, getting money in there, is generating a huge return relative to almost any other investment you could make.
Okay. We haven't talked about dental benefits, and I know there are you can buy policies under this federal program for both dental and eye. So, which are the best federal health plans, if any, for dental benefits?
Sort of three ways you can get them. One is many of the national health plans and HMOs do have some kind of dental benefit along with their health benefit. And a couple of them are pretty extensive. MDIPA, for example, an HMO has a very good dental benefit. There are some that have unofficial arrangements. For example, the letter carriers plan, NALC high option. Well, actually, all three NALC options, and there's two new ones this year. Now is a deal, if you engage in a very modest wellness activity, basically filling out a health questionnaire and sort of agreeing to try to splurge, you know, trying to stop splurging, I should say, and getting a little healthier, you'll get free access to the Cigna Dental Network, okay, where you get a 30% discount. The second, and to most people, the more important category are the separate standalone dental plans where you can join, and there's a case where Self Plus One is a category, Self Plus Plus One or your family. There are three new, there's quite a variety of offerings in that system, and there's three new ones this year. For example, FEP Blue is, you know, has outstanding benefits and a frugal, you know, they have a high and a standard option. And, you know, it's a, for people who have a mouthful of problems, it's a great way to go, even for people who only have a moderate mouthful of problems.
Now, these other plans for eye services and teeth, dental, the government doesn't pay 70% of the premium on those, correct?
No, it pays none of the premium. You pay it all. But here's what's going on. You do get, if you're an employee, this is not annuitants don't get the tax preference, but if you're an active employee, it's tax deductible, okay? It's called, you know, they, for some reason they call it pre-tax. Means if you're paying $500 in dental premium, it's taking $500 off what your federal, state, and local income tax and OASDI tax. So you really, it's really only cost you probably a third less, $350, something like that. So you're getting a discount on the premium because of the tax preference, and you're getting the network discount. A very important thing for these plans is you want to, your dentist has to be in the network. Okay. That's where the big savings are.
Very good. Well, thanks so much for being here. I know we're going to do this again next weekend. Thank you. If you stay tuned, we're going to be talking with Andy Medici from Federal Times here on Federal News Radio 1500 and federalnewsradio.com. Mike Cozy here. Welcome back to Your Turn. We're going to be talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times about a whole variety of things. Andy, are you with us?
Yes, it's good to be here, Mike.
Good. Thank you for batting cleanup again today.
Of course, always a pleasure.
We've got a lot of neat stuff going on, and I guess one of the topics du jour is healthcare.gov.
The way that we organize around these projects, these are all things that we need to look at and take a hard look at to see if we're doing them right.
Well, I think what struck a lot of people, and I know you spoke about it, Jason Miller, our executive editor here, wrote a column about it, is the fact that nobody's taking responsibility for this. At those House hearings the other day, you know, they had the top federal officials and one of the contractors, and they said, not me.
Well, you know, you're definitely right. They all, you know what they say, failure's an orphan.
Yes.
But at the same time, the way federal agencies are structured, there is a lot of shared responsibility. Ultimately, there are executives who should take responsibility, but so many employees work as a team or as a group or as part of an organizational effort that sometimes it is hard to point specifically at one person. And I think when a project fails in this way or is failing in this way and needs to be fixed, people really do want someone to step forward. And you're right, so far that hasn't really happened.
Okay, well, yeah, and I know you don't, you're not a magician, don't have a crystal ball, but do you think any federal workers are going to be thrown under the bus as a result of this, career people?
I really don't think so. You know, in projects past, we have heard calls from Congress about, you know, people having to step down or retire or, you know, resign. But I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of realization that these are systemic problems. If in terms of career officials, I don't see anyone really pushing for the removal of career officials.
Yeah, I mean, you had some of that with the IRS situation. They said it was limited to a few people in the Cincinnati area and sort of seemed to wiggle out of that.
Right. I mean, I think we both know that it is really hard to remove a career official, especially when it's a sort of a project failure like this, as opposed to some sort of misconduct or some sort of criminal activity.
Yeah. Well, how hard is Congress looking at the contractor?
Well, I think for a lot of congressmen, they're really looking at the agency processes. For a lot of it, the contractors, even though they've borne some of the brunt of this, you know, they're private sector companies that are sort of working under federal rules. So I think a lot of people are looking more at CMS and at HHS in terms of what their processes are. But I don't think any of the contractors are really going to suffer from this. You know, a lot of them are engaged in projects all across the government, and they're the usual suspects that you might call up to do a project like this.
Sure must make the contractors happy that it works that way. You said you wanted to talk about IT procurement reform, and this is, I know this is vital and it's multi-million dollar thing. What are we talking about here?
Well, President Obama did call that. He said that there was sort of a systemic problem, that it was burdensome. And I think something that you hear about from a lot of people is that IT reform is a long and cumbersome process. And, of course, part of that's by design. You have to be fair to companies and give them a chance to compete. But when projects take 2 or 3 or 4 years, do you think you're really going to be getting the latest, sort of the best, the most effective technology, you know, especially since, you know, if you have a cell phone for more than a year, there's probably 5 generations more that you could go out and purchase. So it's really just looking at shortening the time frame and trying to figure out ways to bring in new companies to sort of refresh the supply chain and the companies that can participate, bring in new blood, bring in people with new ideas, and try to get them to participate in the system as well.
Yeah, well, this is Greek to many people, but it's very important stuff, I know.
Well, you know, that's one of those things is that, you know, procurement reform is never a sexy subject. But
yeah,
at the end of the day, you know, it's billions of dollars. And I think it's important that we're always taking a look at that.
Hey, talk about the FBI for a minute. The J. Edgar Hoover building downtown is within sight of the Capitol. It's between the White House and the Capitol. It's a fortress. If you've ever been in it, getting in it is amazing. You go in past these various levels of security, and then you go into kind of a Star Trek door that turns you around, and you zip in. But that said, a lot of FBI officials are worried about its proximity. It's right on the street. The great fear is a truck bomb or something like that, as it is for a lot of federal buildings downtown. And there's been talk of moving it. Virginia wants it. Maryland wants it. The district wants to keep it. Is there any movement on that?
Well, yeah, GSA, they issued sort of an expression of interest to look for properties around the area. Now, this isn't going to be a quick process. They're going to sort of gather up a list of both private and government-owned land that they could build upon. They're going to take about probably until March 2014. They'll finalize a short list, and then they'll eventually more than likely award the final contract sometime in 2015. But the idea is that they want a fresh building. The FBI building was made, of course, pre-9/11 security standards, so there are worries about, you know, truck bombs, about those sorts of issues. But also, it was made during a time when the FBI dealt a lot in paper, and a lot more records are digital now. That is not a high requirement as a sort of a fully functioning, up-to-date facility that they can really work out of.
Well, back when the Department of Homeland Security was established, there was a tremendous amount of speculation as to where it was going to be. And when we were pursuing it here, and as with the rest of the news media, it's a major operation. Obviously, whoever gets it, they stand to make a lot of money in people moving there and spending money there and whatnot. And it was rumored to be everywhere, in Alexandria, in West Virginia. At one point, they had it at Tyson's Corners, and one of the newspapers had a front-page story listing the site and how much it was going to cost. And we had a skull session here, and I said nobody in their right mind would move anything to Tyson's Corners, particularly something like Homeland Security. And lo and behold, they moved it just a couple of blocks from where we are broadcasting right now, and then eventually it's going to go up over into Southeast. Do you think, given Virginia's track record in attracting federal agencies, and particularly law enforcement agencies, do you think Virginia has a leg up on this?
Looking at what they offer, I think Virginia does. As you said before, there are a lot of law enforcement agencies. There are FBI resources in Virginia already as well. And part of this is that there is some more vacant government land. You know, Federal News Radio as well as Federal Times have covered some of the prospective sites. And you know, there's already one in Springfield that, although has some issues, might be there too. Because remember, this search isn't just for private landowners and for private land, but GSA said they wouldn't rule out government-owned land, and of course GSA happens to own some in Virginia. I think that Virginia does sort of have a leg up in the process, and that, you know, Maryland, you know, other counties are really going to have to work hard to make the case.
Well, it's almost as if, you know, they divided the world as they did in the old days and gave Maryland the biotech and whatnot, and gave Virginia the other tech and the law enforcement. And, you know, you see the CIA is there, the FBI headquarters in Quantico, and a number of other operations. So I would think they'd have a leg up.
Well, you know, you always see certain types of businesses cluster. Why? They're always, you know, 100 car dealerships right next to each other. And it's because they want to be, you know, law enforcement agencies, they want to be near each other. They want to have that ease of access to each other. And, you know, biotech and other information sharing agencies, they want to be close too. So like tends to attract like, and in this case, there are a lot of resources in Virginia that the FBI would have access to if they were close by.
Hey, we got about a minute and a half. What are you working on now?
Well, actually, I'm working on a story. GSA is exploring a way to add sort of cost reimbursable options to its schedule system, something that they haven't really done before, but they're really exploring it. DOD has been pushing for sort of a cost reimbursable system so they can really sort of push down how much they pay for certain services. And so that's something that GSA is actually looking at, although that process will also be sort of a long informational process.
After the Congressional Budget Office put out its, and I won't say hit list, but it was a list of ways the government could save money, six out of 100 plus were directed at government. And I guess the one that worries the organized federal worker and retiree groups most is this chained CPI.
Well, you know, that's something that we always talk about. It's always that that one thing that people keep worrying about, and every so often there's a resurgence, and it's sometimes, you know, it sort of dies down. And I think what we really have to look for is that it would be part of a broader package, but at this moment there seems to be less support for it than there was maybe during the first debt deal a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and that didn't work. And I guess there are times when bittering and division on Capitol Hill can work to federal workers' advantage.
Exactly.
Very good. Okay, thank you so much, Andy Medici, for being here. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Walt Francis, for being a guest. And thank you, Lauren Larson, for working the buttons, talking on the phone. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.